Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing professional development for all GOC-registered optometrists. With case studies and in-depth conversations, each month we explore the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. In optometry, exciting new products or treatments are constantly coming onto the market. And as practitioners, we need to keep our knowledge up to date so that we can offer solutions to our patients if they present with an ocular condition. An example that springs to mind are the use of supplements that have been claimed to help with various things such as vitreous floaters, dry eye, or macular health. But how do we know if the product will do what it says? What is the research evidence? What is the sample size used? And how many studies have actually been carried out? Are the results reproducible? Has the study been funded and conducted independently? In other words, when we see innovations in eye care that can sometimes make national headlines with a promise of potential benefits for patients, is the evidence strong enough to make a recommendation or to provide that treatment to a patient? This month, we'll be tapping into the expertise and resources of the College of Optometrists to explore the importance of evidence-based practice with one of its clinical advisors. And we'll highlight that analysing research is not a purely academic exercise, but one that applies to everyday optometry. We should all be taking an evidence-based approach to our clinical practice. So, to help us navigate through this minefield of questions is Paramdeep Bilku, a clinical advisor at the College of Optometrists. Hi, Paramdeep.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
And I've also got IP optometrist Alan Harami, who joins us from his practice in Tonbridge, Kent. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Paramdeep, let's start with you. What is evidence-based practice?
Oh, that's a great question to start. I mean, essentially, evidence-based practice is a method of making clinical decisions with a view to providing the best possible care to patients. And it just not only combines research evidence, it also combines clinical expertise and patient preferences. So that means when it comes to making a decision, it's not just based upon published evidence, but also it signifies you should take into account the wishes of your patient and the circumstances that they're in, as well as your own professional judgment. And to do that, you need to ensure that your patients understand the efficacy of the treatment, the risks involved, and carefully weigh all three of those elements before making a clinical decision with the patient.
So as a clinical advisor, and you're a member of the clinical advisor team that are responsible for many of the college guidelines, can you give me a quick overview of the process that you might go through at the college when thinking about guidelines?
I think a really good example is the clinical management guidelines. Essentially, they are written and regularly updated by a dedicated writing team. To give you an overview about how the steps are involved in developing a CMG, the first step is to look at a series of clinical questions, which are then framed in terms of our search technique. And we use an appropriate electronic bibliographic database like Embase or Medline or PubMed. And we use those search filters then to filter out the ones that are relevant for us. Now, once we get those suitable abstracts, the next step is a critical appraisal. And that's involving reading the full text with respect to methodology, significance, applicability of the results. And so once we do the evidence appraisal, we then translate those recommendations based on the balance between the quality of the evidence, the benefits, the risks, and the burdens to make a clinical recommendation. And we use something called the grade system. Now, that's a system which assesses the certainty of the evidence and the strength of the recommendation. And in this context, the hierarchy of evidence is really important, as there are some studies which have a greater propensity to bias, which mean they could get downgraded according to the grade rating. And then once the updates have been made to the CMG draft, they're then sent out for peer review within a dedicated review group. And once you get that feedback, we then collate them, they're considered, and we refine the drafts before they're then sent to our Education Standards Committee for approval. So you can see there's quite a robust structure involved in the college in terms of the development, but also the sign-off and approval process.
So when it comes to the CMGs or the clinical management guidelines, there's many, many hours of reading that goes on in the background that many of us will be unaware of when we're actually reading them and using them in practice.
There's quite a lot, and you're right. I'm also very grateful to our review groups, which are made up of our members, particularly a lot of IP optometrists.
I'm one of them.
And Alan is one of them as well. So we're very grateful for their input.
Alan, your role is different to a typical high street optometrist. Can you tell me a little bit more about what you do and how your practice is different?
Yeah, so half of our business is community ophthalmology, where we'd get patients that are referred from other local optometrists, GPs, referred from 111, out of hours A&E, minor injuries unit. So we see a wide variety of emergency patients, but then at the same time, we get patients that have been, you know, lost to follow up from the hospital, needing refinement for glaucoma management if needed. So we have to look at a whole load of evidence-based practice to be able to determine what we're going to do for certain patients.
So it really is bringing ophthalmology into the community, so it's far more accessible for patients.
Yes.
So what does evidence-based practice mean to you?
When I think about evidence-based practice, it's being able to find the best available research to guide the decisions I'm going to make clinically. But then you also have to remember that these patients that are sitting in your chair don't typically fall into what would be the study parameters. All our patients are different, and they're not always going to be that same patient that's going to get the same treatment result.
I think when it comes to the evidence, obviously there's lots of published guidelines available that the college produces. There's also documents from NICE. Yes, there are guidelines available, but they're there as a framework to support you, not something to rely on solely. You need to make sure that you apply your professional judgment. And that's the key underlying principle of being a clinician, is making those decisions. And that is what our patients value and trust.
Now, I wanted to structure this podcast around the hierarchy of evidence that's available for us to use, and perhaps go through some examples as we think about the relative value of different types of evidence. If we think about the lowest form of evidence, I would have thought that would be anecdotal evidence. Perhaps when a patient comes in and they've said, oh, I've heard about my neighbour, she's read a story in the newspaper, or, you know, her cousin's had this treatment for AMD. Is anecdotal evidence ever of any use when we're trying to decide, is this something that we should recommend in practice?
It is a great question, because anecdotes often used in other areas of marketing, for example, you know, quite widely, say a personal recommendation, it sits quite strongly with people. But when it comes to making a clinical decision, a personal experience or an anecdote, they are subject to a high probability of bias. And so as a starting point, they are not of sufficient quality to form the basis of a general treatment recommendation. So our view of good practice is that as responsible clinicians should strive wherever possible is to recommend treatments where there's an established evidence base, showing that they are safe and effective and in the patient's best interest. So that actually places a much higher level of integrity on clinicians, and rightly so in my view, compared to those on social media or online who often anecdotally advocate or promote these types of products.
Alan, something that springs to my mind when we're thinking about anecdotal evidence, and will be something that's in the mind of practitioners out there, are blue lights blocking lenses. Do you remember when they were sort of being talked about in the press and also within the profession? And why do you think patients might be tempted by them?
Yeah, I mean, I remember there was a multiple, I think, where they were fined by the GOC because they stated that it prevents damage to the eyes. There were claims that it reduced eye strain, improved quality of sleep, and they'd said that it prevents visual damage. That's something that patients hang on to.
Did you have any patients yourself asking about them at the time?
We still get them. So we still get patients every now and then who ask, oh, can I take supplements for this? And I kind of explain the evidence that, can I do this? And then add in that, can I do the blue light? And then I have to kind of stress that there's no direct link substantiated between blue light and retinal damage. So I keep having to remind them that if you want to, you can, but there's no guarantee that it's going to help you in any way.
Paramdeep, was there ever any real evidence to support the use of blue light blocking lenses?
I think that's a good question, but I think the actual initial premise for blue blocking lenses are actually fundamentally flawed. I mean, there's lots of research that's shown that even with very prolonged screen use, the actual level of blue light exposure is far, far lower than that you would receive from a normal dose of daylight. And many of the studies suggesting a possible link with blue light and retinal damage, they're based on lab studies on cells in a dish using a much, much higher intensity blue light, which you would not get in natural circumstances, either outdoors or from a screen. So in short, the reality is there's actually very little blue light emitted from a screen, and there's no direct evidence, as Anna mentioned, showing the link between blue light exposure and the reported eye health effects. So we actually carried out an internal evidence review back in 2017 as a college. And more recently, there was another systematic review undertaken by the Cochrane Group in 2023. And both of these reviews show that these lenses did not provide any additional benefit in reducing those symptoms that Alan described, you know, eye strain, discomfort, visual performance, and that was compared to normal lenses. And also they had an inconclusive effect on improving sleep quality and the risks associated with the development of retinal diseases like AMD. So there's not enough evidence to say that they are effective, but the initial premise is flawed. And it's also worth noting that they actually cause symptoms like discomfort, headache, and eye strain whilst using them. And so it's really important that when, if you do offer these products, that you explain the lack of evidence, but also that they are not free from harm. So that way, that if as an optometrist you do provide them, you are being absolutely clear and honest about the intervention that you provide.
So I hope the guidance from the College of Optometrists and a Cochrane review is enough to put that story to bed then.
I hope so.
So another intervention that we might recommend at the moment is myopia management. And we don't have long-term outcomes about myopia management. So why does that sit differently? What does the college currently say about that?
So we actually published an updated evidence review. And in summary, there are lots of different optical interventions available that are licensed for the UK market. They actually showed a similar statistical significant relative reduction in the rate of myopia. And that was over a period of 1 to 3 years. That's really important to mention the word relative. That is in comparison to the intervention which you're comparing against. It doesn't give you what's called the absolute effect or the effect size, which is of clinical significance. That's what's actually key here. So although it showed a statistical change over 1 to 3 years, a more recent meta-analysis showed that clinically significant changes only took place in the early stages of the treatment process. So whilst there is actually good evidence that they are effective, the most important fact that we took away from this research is preventing or delaying the onset of myopia. And that can be achieved by advising children at risk of developing myopia to spend more time outdoors and limit time spent on non-essential near tasks. And that has a quite strong effect size.
So I guess that's why it's really important to talk about informed consent and really clearly communicating with your patients. What would you say to parents of patients who potentially are thinking about myopia management, Paramdeep?
I think it shouldn't really be a blanket approach. It should be individualised to that patient's needs. So where I feel myopia management may be beneficial, I explain the rationale for slowing down progression and the short and long-term benefits and risks. It's really important to be clear about the length and the cost of the treatment and manage patient and parent expectations using the available evidence. And it's really important to state that, you know, myopia management treatments don't reverse myopia and they don't stop it. They just slow it down. That's really key to stay.
I think the crux of it is it's got to be patient-centred. It's got to be the right thing for that patient, doesn't it?
You're right. And our college guidance, we do actually set out the steps that clinicians should be taking in order to provide that advice in a clear and impartial way and summarise the evidence so people can explain it in an understandable way as well. It is really important that to get informed consent that patients have the capacity but also have all the information available to them, and that includes your practice advertisements and publicity so that they're consistent and accurate. And if they are misleading or they're not accurate, that could invalidate the patient's consent. So it's really important that you make sure that any statements that you put on your advertising, in addition to the chat that you have in the consultation room, are consistent, aligned and evidence-based.
You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we explore the topics that matter the most to optometrists like me and you. That's why we'd like to hear your suggestions for future episodes. So email us. The address is podcast@docket.info, or use LinkedIn to follow and message us here at Docket. There's a link in the podcast description. Today, we've been discussing how optometrists can use evidence to make decisions in practice. For the next scenario, I'd like to turn to you again, Alan, because I know you offer IPL, intense pulsed light treatment, for your patients with meibomian gland dysfunction. So what is the evidence base for how well IPL works?
So there's a variety of different evidence available for it. And some of the evidence is alongside conventional treatments and some of the evidence is standalone. IPL was found to be not better than meibomian gland dysfunction treatment on its own, but it was most effective when it was combined with other treatments. The studies have effectively shown that the improvement in symptoms in patients undergoing the treatment, and then also improvements in objective measures have been found as well, like a function of the gland and tear film stability. What I think is different with this is that there is long-term data out that shows that there is a sustained improvement in these patients, in their symptoms and in their function. And it just shows the potential it has as long-term solution. And as I said, newer studies have also looked at IPL as an adjunct therapy for other treatments, which validates its efficacy and its acceptance in general practice as well.
You bring up an important point. Sometimes treatments, therapies, there is different degrees of evidence depending on whether it's used as a standalone or not. And as we all know, when we talk to patients, when it comes to compliance with MGD regimes, patients are notoriously poor. So yeah, actually giving them something else to do, another tool in the box, as it were, that they can use, it just means it's more likely they're going to have a successful outcome with the whole regime if they've got more than one thing that they can be trying to do.
I mean, MGD is such a chronic issue that patients go through ups and downs and stuff, and mentally it really does affect them. And being able to offer alternative treatments does just lead to happier patients and happier clinician too, because you don't need to keep seeing the same patient again and again.
I think one thing that comes out of this reviews and the studies that you mentioned is that it just goes to underscore the importance of the underlying eyelid hygiene and massage, which is critical to ensuring, you know, the glands are produced in even appropriate quantities and sufficient quality, and that these additional therapies are there as supportive. And so I think that should give us great confidence that as clinicians, we are offering our patients, you know, conservative approaches that we know are evidence-based and are effective. But on top of that, there may not be people who respond to it fully. So there are other alternatives that may be available, and IPL may fall into that category.
So apparently there has been quite a lot of research, as Alan's mentioned, on IPL, and a Cochrane review found that although there is emerging evidence, there's a requirement for more well-designed studies.
Yes.
And, you know, perhaps with a larger sample size to provide further evidence about the efficacy of IPL. So when we think about the long-term impact as well, how relevant are the limitations of the existing studies from the college's perspective? Do you think there's enough evidence to be convincing in the sense that we can feel comfortable about recommending this to our patients?
That's a good question. And in fact, as part of our CMG for blepharitis, there's actually a section where we actually provide a grade rating for IPL treatment in the presence of MGD. Now, based upon the Cochrane review that you mentioned, it actually shows that there's a lack of evidence for its effectiveness and safety alone. And one of the key limitations was sample size, but sample size is just one issue. Now, if you have a large number of people in a study, that means you're more likely to find a statistically significant effect. But having more patients is simply not enough. There needs to be sufficient numbers to answer the research question based upon the statistical approach to the data analysis, and that determines whether any treatment produces a meaningful effect size or practical significance. So although IPL is available, provided optometrists explain that they are not supported by the evidence currently, as long as that's part of the informed consent process, patients may nonetheless choose to undertake IPL. Or if you explain that there is some evidence to show that we're going to continue with our basic conservative therapy, but there is some evidence that shows that actually adding IPL is helpful, the patient then can make an informed decision whether or not they believe it's right for them to proceed.
Alan, if I was a patient that was thinking about or wanting to have IPL because I had MGD, can you talk us through how you might go through a typical consent process?
Yeah, so initially you typically go through the explanation of the procedure, what it is and how it works, why you're doing this, and then going through the benefits of it, and then obviously the risks. And then you would kind of bring it round to how it's suitable for this patient specifically. Risks are always necessary to describe, no matter how rare they are, because if it happens, then it should be put down as a risk. So with something like IPL, luckily, the risks are quite small. So temporary discomfort, redness, irritation, those types of things. And the consent form needs to outline the key points of the discussion. And then I would give the patient a form that explains the procedure and includes the consent form. And I would, before I do anything, I'd tell them to take it home so they'd be able to read through everything that I would discuss. Makes the time for the appointment much more streamlined and straightforward because they're already aware of a lot of the things you're going to say, but also they would have already formulated a lot of their questions that they're going to ask you, so it makes the whole process a lot easier. And then before the procedure, I would get the patient to sign showing that they agree with the procedure going ahead. Then I'd give them a copy of it as well as adding it to their own records.
Let's move on to talk about another light therapy, actually, that's emerging. And optometrists are very interested in this because there are instruments being made available for you to invest in and have in practice. And that's to do with AMD, red light therapies for AMD. So quite often patients will see headlines in newspapers heralding these light treatments as potential miracle cures. And it's actually quite difficult sometimes to get to the bottom of what the actual evidence is, and is it going to mean something significant for AMD patients? So Paramdeep, I'm just going to bring this back to you. As far as you're concerned, what evidence do you think is actually out there for these emerging therapies?
First thing you need to say is that there are always going to be new technologies, new therapies that emerge over time with shifting treatment paradigms and clinical contexts. And in this case, it's not an area that I'm overly familiar with, but from the limited studies that are available so far, I would say we need to watch and wait and watch this space, although the results initially seem promising, because particularly for people with dry AMD, there's very, very little we can do to help prevent converting to a wet AMD or to actually prevent it from getting worse. So if there are treatments available, we need to make sure that we manage patient expectations, because they'll be very vulnerable to the suggestion that any type of treatment will be helpful.
Yes, I think we do need studies that have got a large cohort of patients. And the other thing that worries me as well, Paramdeep, is that sometimes when I look at some of the studies, I wonder if they're biased in any way because they are perhaps sponsored by equipment manufacturers.
That's a good point. And when it comes as part of the critical appraisal, when you look at a paper, one of the key things you look at is where was the study conducted, who was conducting it, how it was funded, because they actually are forms of bias which may impact the validity and the reliability of the results. And so where actual manufacturers produce and publish their data, it's really important that they're really clear about their financial disclosures or interests in that product. Because when it comes to actually determining whether a treatment is effective or not, or safe or not, we need to look at those factors in order to establish whether or not they are a reliable source of information. So I would look to the peer-reviewed independent literature to draw more reasonable conclusions.
Alan, your practice is very much around community-based ophthalmology, so I'm sure you do see patients with AMD. And is this therapy, this red light therapy, is this something that you might consider for your practice? You know, what would it take for you to make a decision? Yes, that's something that we might want to have in our practice or offer.
I would approach it the same as I do with a lot of other treatments, and that's basically decide if there's enough of a benefit to the cohort of patients I see and that come through my chair. And then also, as Paramdeep said, is it worth the investment for that equipment? You know, if it treats one out of every 100 patient, then no, it's not worth that investment. I think with newer studies coming out that have a high number of participants and higher quality studies, I think that will enable you to make an informed decision on whether I'd want to offer it. But at this point, I would say no.
And finally, from both of you, if we go to Alan first, what are your recommendations for where optometrists can find useful information, useful evidence, and you know, how do they go about interpreting it?
I mean, the internet, we're so lucky today where we've got the ability to get search results in under a second, obviously depending on your internet connection. But PubMed is great. I like iWiki as well because they reference all their recommendations too. So you can follow where they've got their recommendations from, which does help a lot. I would say that if you're not able to find any evidence online for what you need in under 5 minutes, then I'd be wary of it.
Good tip. Paramdeep, what about you? Any recommendations from yourself?
Yeah, my first initial advice would be to look to the college for guidance. We have a wide range of resources on a huge number of topics. I know on the CMG pages, if you click the study, it'll take you straight through to the paper so you can read it for yourself where we drew the recommendations from. But it's really important to mention that guidance is non-exhaustive. It doesn't cover every scenario for every patient for every condition. And there are new treatments and paradigms development all of the time. So as a health professional, it's really important that you keep up to date with the evidence on all the treatments that you provide. Now, the best sources that I find are things like PubMed, Cochrane Library, and that can help you keep informed of the latest developments. But critical appraisal, I mean, that's what you touched on earlier, but that's a skill that can be learned, but it can be quite daunting to start that initially. So there's lots of resources actually available online that can be found very quickly that can give you almost like a crash course in how a health professional should approach appraising the evidence. Now, my advice to people looking at the evidence would be to look at the methodology section, and that way you can look at the study design and the potential limitations. And for studies that look at treatments, recognize that randomized controlled trials or RCTs are the best source of evidence because they provide not only the highest quality results, but also have a lower risk of bias. So you're more likely to have a valid report that you can trust and turn to.
That's all really good advice. I just wanted to conclude by going beyond those randomised control trials that you've mentioned, Paramdeep. If I personally don't have time to search the literature in detail, I read systematic reviews and I find them really useful. So these are papers which combine and compare all the high quality findings from randomised controlled trials for a specific intervention. And finding them is actually not that difficult. Cochrane, which we've mentioned throughout this podcast, is a body set up to analyse medical research findings, which helps to facilitate evidence-based choices. So that's one of the first places that I would look, alongside the college guidelines, of course, which have a lot of research, analysis and thought put into them. So even if you can't dive into every single randomised controlled trial paper, there are plenty of useful resources to make informed decisions about your clinical practice, and you can access those at the click of a button. Paramdeep, Alan, thank you both very much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't forget that if you head to docket.info and search for sound optometry, you can find the additional reading materials and resources for this episode. And by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain one CPD point covering professionalism and communication. We'll be back again next month with another episode of Sound Optometry following the Docket webinar on handling complaints. So make sure you hit subscribe on your podcast app so that you don't miss out. That's all from us. The producer is Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.